The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Second hour of the Bible study, the Ask the Pastor hour. If you'd like to come on with questions or comments that are on your mind, our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. If you're listening to us in or around Evansville, Indiana, you can use that toll-free number to come on the radio and talk with our guest in this hour, Dr. Martin Noland. He's pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville. Good morning, Pastor.
Morning.
Have you been hammered by this weather out there in Evansville?
No, today is pretty good. I think we got a lot of snow on Thursday. I was up in Fort Wayne that day, but it's all plowed out, and today was there really isn't much out there. It's comfortable. It's cold, of course, but it's we're not snowed under like some other parts of the country are.
It'll be spring before you know it.
You said it.
You know, Ash Wednesday is really late this year. Easter is really late. When that happens in that cycle, as it does, moving around all the time, do you pastors tend to prefer an early Ash Wednesday and an early Easter, or a late Ash Wednesday and a late Easter?
Well, we get it both ways, so we don't have a lot of say in that. I think a lot of us like this, the time between the New Year and Ash Wednesday is a time that a lot of pastors kind of take a breath. They pick up on work that they've had to put aside because of the holiday season. And that holiday season for pastors, which is a very busy time, starts in Thanksgiving week, and it goes through New Year's.
Yeah.
So you're looking at 5-6 weeks when you're pretty much on the go all the time. And so whether that involves picking up some visits to shut-ins that you haven't done for a while, a little bit of planning if you're behind on that, catching up on Bible study, most guys do at least a little bit of prep before they walk into Bible class. That's the time to do some catch up. And so having a little more time is actually not a bad thing. Most of the pastors, I think, feel that way. And they always feel constrained when Ash Wednesday comes early, because then you don't have much time in that period.
Well, the first subject I want to talk about here as we kind of conform our discussion in some ways to the march in Washington, which is underway today. For those people who are of the pro-life persuasion, there is a demonstration in Washington, as there is every January, in or around the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision so many years ago. I have an article here titled, "The Case for Killing Granny, Rethinking End-of-Life Care." Let me just read a little bit of this. It's a long article, but I'll read a few paragraphs. The author says, "My mother wanted to die, but the doctors wouldn't let her. At least that's the way it seemed to me as I stood by her bed in an intensive care unit at a hospital in Hilton Head, South Carolina, 5 years ago. My mother was 79, a longtime smoker who was dying of emphysema. She knew that her quality of life was increasingly tethered to an oxygen tank, that she was losing her ability to get about, and that she was slowly drowning. The doctors at her bedside were recommending various tests and procedures to keep her alive, but my mother, with a certain firmness I recognized, said no. She seemed puzzled and a bit frustrated that she had to be so insistent on her own demise. The hospital at my mother's assisted living facility was sustained by Medicare, which pays by the procedure. I don't think the doctors were trying to be greedy by pushing more treatments on my mother. That's just the way the system works. The doctors were responding to the expectations of almost all patients. As a doctor friend of mine puts it, quote, 'Americans want the best. They want the latest, and they want it now,' unquote. We expect doctors to make heroic efforts, especially to save our lives and the lives of our loved ones. The idea that we might ration health care to seniors or anyone else is political anathema. Politicians do not dare breathe the R word, lest they be accused, however wrongly, of trying to pull the plug on Grandma. But the need to spend less money on the elderly at the end of life is the elephant in the room in the health reform debate. Everyone sees it, but no one wants to talk about it. At a more basic level, Americans are afraid not just of dying, but of talking and thinking about death. Until Americans learn to contemplate death as more than a scientific challenge to be overcome, our health care system will remain unfixable. So the direction that this article is taking, under the subheading Rethinking End-of-Life Care, is that keeping people alive when they are elderly and spending lots and lots and lots of money to do it may be an unsustainable thing. We are at the top of the slippery slope here, Pastor. What's your reaction to this article?
Was that in a secular newspaper?
I got it off of ChristianPost.com.
And it sounds like the author is critical of what's going on around us. Is that correct? That's my impression.
I think she sees in her own personal experience a moment where a loved one of hers wanted to die, knew that her future was never going to be better because of her emphysema, and instead of doing what seemed natural in that circumstance, the doctors were getting ready to tap Medicare for still more bills and charges to keep her 79-year-old mother alive. And I guess in her perspective, that doesn't make any sense. From a human standpoint, from a budget standpoint, from an ethical standpoint, and she's talking about her mother.
Right. Well, the thing is that a lot of people will claim the name Christian, but they don't think or feel Christian. I mean, you know, for them, being a Christian means go to church and have a good time. I mean, well, frankly, a lot of churches are more geared toward entertainment today. So they don't have anything in their religious background that equips them for dealing with the tough things of life and being ready to take up the burden, whatever it is. So just because this person was a Christian doesn't really mean that he or she really has really thought through this in the right way. There's been a lot of discussion about this. I don't know how far back it goes, but when I was at seminary, we took a course in what's called bioethics, and we covered, we read through a lot of books by different religious authors. The majority of the discussion that's gone on here, I think, has been in the Roman Catholic Church by what they call their moral theologians. That is, theologians whose specialty is in the area of ethics. And others have written, both from a liberal and conservative perspective, different denominations. So this really isn't something that you would say that Lutherans have a unique perspective on, or that conservatives necessarily would have a unique perspective on. I think most Christians are going to come on about the same place on most of these issues. They don't come on the same place on the abortion issue. That tends to be a liberal-conservative divide. But so far, anyway, most of the Christians that are writing about this that have expertise in ethics are pretty much in agreement. If you want to know what the Missouri Synod says officially on this, I just brought it up to my website as you were talking. There is a document at the Missouri Synod website. You go to lcms.org, and you go to the section that deals with CTCR. That's our Commission on Theology and Church Relations. And they have a document from 1993 titled Christian Care at Life's End. And you can download that for free. And it goes through both what a Lutheran perspective is on this and why we have this. And it has about 12 different principles. It's very helpful to pastors in particular to become aware of this, because they're often asked, and I've been asked several times in my career, whether or not they should pull the plug on Granny, to put it in the language that you brought up here. And because I'm not a doctor, I don't always know what's going on medically with the patient. So it requires some thought about what type of questions do I need to ask the family, and then once I kind of get a sense for what's going on, trying to explain to them some of the principles involved. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, in its adoption of this document and other things at its conventions, has not said that we are sustaining biological life of humans at all costs in all circumstances, you know, as if you have a whole line of people that are all lined up on machines and that's the only thing that's keeping them alive. The basic principle is that artificial means to keep people alive, that is machines, are useful, and they should be used if they can sustain life. And the rule there is that if you take the machine off and the person cannot sustain themselves, so for example, if they're on a breathing tube or what they call a ventilator, and they after the doctors have done everything they can for the individual, and they take the ventilator off and the person is not able still to breathe, there is nothing wrong ethically from taking the ventilator off and just letting the person naturally die, because at that point the systems that keep the breathing going aren't going to work. A bigger question that comes up with older people, and I've had a number of cases like this, where they are, they're mentally out of it. They may sleep most of the day. They may lie in bed most of the day. But if you give them something to eat or drink, they'll eat or drink it. And then the question is, well, this person is just kind of just lying there, or they're asleep all the time, or semi-comatose, but not always, because they're able to eat and to drink. Whether or not we can withhold nourishment and water for them, and I think that's where the kind of the debate is, whether that's right or wrong. And I believe that feeding a person is a natural thing, and that's what you do with babies. And if you don't feed and hydrate a baby, they can't do that for themselves, and they will die. And I think so on the other end of life, that is, and as you're drawing near to heaven for a Christian, you're still obligated to hydrate and to nourish that person. But other types of care, they've used a lot of terms for that. Other types of care, like machines and all that, if it's not going to do any good and the body's not going to sustain itself, then you can take that off, and it is an ethical and correct thing to do if you've done everything else that you can.
There are so many people who, for example, people who are in Washington today for the march, the pro-life march, they have a pro-life perspective. They have a committed pro-life stance because of what they believe as Christians.
Right.
Not all people have that. Some people are atheists and they're pro-life. They think it through, and they think the pro-life position makes sense to them. But very, very many people hold a pro-life position because they believe that it's consistent with what the Word of God teaches. So now comes this 79-year-old woman. I looked this up again. This was in Newsweek, actually, in September of 2009, this article, The Case for Killing Granny. Now you have a 79-year-old woman who has emphysema and who is dying. We have the possibility now, Pastor, to transplant lungs. And so if it were to happen that a pair of healthy lungs became available, somebody's going to have to ask and answer the question as to whether or not we should transplant these youthful lungs into this 79-year-old woman. And what if there is a 54-year-old person who needs a lung transplant? Somebody has to ask and answer the question, well, ethically, is it more appropriate to transfer this living tissue resource into the 54-year-old instead of the 79-year-old, because the 54-year-old could conceivably get more use out of them. These are questions, it doesn't seem to me, that the Bible has answers to. And if you're going to have a pro-life position and say, no, it's wrong to kill Granny, you know, it's what you got to do is care for her until she expires on her own, it's wrong to kill her, then you got to deal with these other questions about heart transplants and liver transplants and lung transplants and all these other medical questions that it seems to me the Bible is silent on. How do you handle that?
Yeah, the term that's used by the ethicists that are in this field is it just occurred to me that the title is heroic measures. So these are things that we can do now in the 21st century that we couldn't do 40 years ago. I remember when Life magazine had the article on DeBakey in South Africa, the very first heart transplant. That was really the first transplant of anything. And the guy didn't live very long, but it was successful because he did live for a couple of days. It's the advent of transplants and of medical technology that takes over the functioning of the human body. This is what's known as heroic measures, and it's brought in a whole other issue that the Christian church didn't have to deal with, and it's not addressed in the Bible. And now my personal opinion on, and this fits in what the CTCR document says, is that heroic measures may be done, but they are not required to be done. Because, again, you're altering the course of what's naturally going to happen to that body. And so, really, these are not so much ethical, they're political issues. And that, for example, you say with this lung, does the person who is 55 get it, or the person who's 85? Well, when you talk about limited resources and who gets them, that's a political issue. So the old folks may be, you know, rising up and marching on Washington. You know, we get all the lung transplants, and the 50-year-olds. So what you've done is created a not you, but you created a political thing that is not addressed by Scripture or by ethics. And so that's going to be a problem for the politicians to figure out. There is only a limited amount of transplants, of medical care, of a lot of these things. Some people will not get it. And that's, I think, why the whole the healthcare reform is so toxic for our American life today, is because it means it's rationing. And who wants to be denied medical care if it could be, you know, giving you many more years of life?
Back in 1973, when the Roe v. Wade decision was handed down, I wonder if there were any Americans who could envision what we now call the abortion industry and abortion clinics across the country. We have discovered here from some insider information here in recent months that these clinics have, some of them have quotas of how many abortions they're supposed to do. And we see corruption. We see billions of dollars in this industry, which I don't think we probably could have envisioned in 1973. Can you envision a euthanasia industry, Pastor, maybe 10, 15 years down the road, where people will wheel grandma or grandpa into the building there, pay a fee of $250, $300 or so to have their elderly loved one euthanized, the body then sent to the funeral home, and everything proceeds pretty much the way you would expect? Can you envision an industry in our future?
Well, if the government, on the basis of what the people want, if that's what people want, then it'll go that way. It'll have to be regularized. In a society like ours, you won't be able to take out a shotgun and blow grandma away. You can't do that. So it has to be regularized, and it has to be medical, and it has to all be, has to look
sort of like the abortion industry is now.
Exactly. So I think if euthanasia becomes law, which I don't see that it's going to become law, I mean, just because we have differences of opinion or disagreements about what type of care should be used or withheld does not mean that we're going to a euthanized state. But that is a possibility. The thing is, there's a lot of repercussions, and the question is, in the case of end-of-life, and you start doing... By the way, I have some 90-year-old men in my congregation, and they're very lucid. In fact, when we sit down and talk, they begin telling me what's going on in the political realm, because I'm too busy to watch the politics, and they do. They watch TV, and then they tell me what's going on. So then if you have these men and women that are, except for their mobility, they can't get around very much, they're in really good health and mental awareness, where does that stop? If you say, well, once you're 90, then you're gone, or once you're 80, then you're gone, or once you're 60, well, wait a sec, we're getting too close now, you know? So, that is what kind of holds people back, because there is no definite point at which everybody dies. It's all stretched out over a period of time, and some people have better health than others. Whereas with abortion, there is a definite point at which somebody is born. And after that, you have a child. You don't have a fetus or a child that's inside the womb. So because there's that definite breaking point, the law can say you can abort any time up until the point that it's born. And then it's not an abortion. Then it's infanticide, and it's something different. So I think that it's not likely that the process by which that abortion came into this country, that euthanasia would come in the same way. It's more likely in a tyrannical or dictatorship government where the top down says, this is it, and we have limited resources, and we're going to cut off granny. And that's what happened in Hitler's Europe. There was euthanasia there for people with a variety of disabilities. They hadn't gotten to the point of getting rid of older people, but they could have easily have done that. So I think you're more likely to see that type of issue showing up in a tyrannical society, let's say like North Korea.
Leading up to the 1973 decision to make abortion on demand legal in the United States, I remember that we were being told that it's not right, it's not fair, that women would have to go to back alley abortionists to get the service they needed because it was unregulated, it was dangerous, and it was inappropriate. We were also told that it was not fair that some states had allowed abortions and some states did not. That meant that you had to travel to out of state if you were in a state that didn't allow abortion. That wasn't fair, and so we needed to have this abortion on demand. Those at the time seemed to be fairly good reasons, but I don't know that people anticipated billions and billions of dollars abortion industry where clinics have quotas as to how many women they get into their clinics. When it becomes profitable to euthanize grandpa or grandma, then there will be quotas, Pastor. And if somebody goes into the clinic for counseling as to whether or not they really ought to do this or not, I can't feel good that they're going to be counseled in a way that is not prejudiced in the direction of the $300. And I'm concerned about it. And I think that this is part of our future, and the slippery slope is very slippery. Do you think I'm overreacting?
I don't think you're overreacting. I think we have to be concerned because the Christian basis for our society. And I'm not saying that the U.S. Constitution was a Christian document. It was not. It was influenced by Christian ethics, but it was not. It was intended to have a society of a wide variety of religious opinions or beliefs, and that's the way our society has always been. But the majority of people in the United States, and they've exerted their political preference, has been Christian up until recent times. Even in somewhat lax or reduced, but today it's almost just no Christianity or religion at all.
All right, hold that thought right there. We're going to take our bottom of the hour break. We're talking with Dr. Martin Nolan, Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. We'll be back.
Concordia Seminary has four core values, and one core value is excellence. People today demand the very best. Even people who ignore or misrepresent God's word of truth often strive for excellence. So shouldn't we strive all the more for excellence in our churches and seminary? Pastoral leaders will hold excellence high, helping invite people to the truth of our message. If it's in the headlines, we'll think about it. If it's a topic of conversation at the water cooler, we'll discuss it. If it's something we need to remember, I'll remind you. Hi, this is Dale Meyer, inviting you to hear the Meyer Minute on KFUO Radio. Weekday mornings and afternoons, I'll bring you fresh commentary from a Christian perspective. The Meyer Minute, addressing today's topics the way God sees it on KFUO Radio.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Today I'm in Washington, D.C., along with a few hundred thousand of my closest pro-life friends. We've gathered for the annual March for Life. We're joined by tens of thousands of others holding events in their local communities. All of us are publicly standing up for unborn babies and their mothers who are victims of the abortion industry. As we march, I ask you to pray. Pray God will bring an end to the modern-day Holocaust of abortion. Pray He'll effectively use us to bring about this change. Pray for women and men who are faced with an unexpected pregnancy and considering abortion. Please also pray for the many mothers and fathers who've chosen abortion and now struggle with their decision. Every 23 seconds, another heart is stilled by abortion.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org. And stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Abortion protest. I'm Norman Hall with Religion Roundup. Abortion opponents are gathered in Washington for an annual day of protest timed to counter the anniversary of the 1973 Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. Alliance Defense Fund counsel David French, who spoke at a gathering of students opposed to abortion, believes they will see Roe versus Wade overturned.
In their lifetime, we'll see Roe overturned, but if you overturn Roe, you still don't end abortion. Roe returns the issue to the states and to the people.
Egypt's interior minister is blaming radical Islamists from Gaza with planning and carrying out the New Year's Day bombing of a Coptic Christian church in Alexandria, Egypt. The blast killed 21 people and sparked 3 days of rioting by Christians. The group Army of Islam denies the claim. A Holocaust memorial in Israel has launched a Farsi language YouTube channel to counter efforts by Iran's president to deny the Holocaust. There are identical channels in English, Hebrew, Arabic, Russian, and Spanish. With Religion Roundup, I'm Norman Hall.
If you'd like to sit in on one of our Bible study broadcasts, here's good news. We're taking the Bible study on the road. On Thursday, January 27th, we'll originate our regular Bible study program from Village Lutheran Church in Ladue. Pastor Kevin Golden will be both our host and our guest. Why don't you come to our live broadcast and bring a friend? Lunch will be served afterwards. I hope to see you Thursday, January 27th, 10 in the morning, for our live Bible study program from Village Lutheran Church in Ladue.
Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. These words from our Savior anchor the theme of the Women's Day of Renewal at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville. Take a vacation with God March 11th and 12th and hear Phyllis Wallace cruise around chaos with the one who calms the seas. You'll also hear Ruth Cook on A Little Vacation with God, Sabbath Keeping for Today's Busy Woman. There are workshops on a variety of topics. Find out the details at goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
You listen to the Bible study. I'm Chuck Rathard. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I have this picture in my mind that there are people who are listening to us as we discuss this article, The Case for Killing Granny, which recently was put up on ChristianPost.com. That's how it came to be relevant again, even though it was published about a year and a half ago. And I'm thinking there are people listening to us, and they're horrified. I'm thinking there may be some people listening to us who are a little disappointed or put out with me for even bringing this discussion onto the radio with our guest, Dr. Martin Noland. And I'm thinking that those same people believed in 1971 or 72 that we weren't going to get abortion on demand, and certainly there wouldn't come a time when abortion would become the major industry that it has become in the United States. So do you think I'm more right or more wrong to talk about this uncomfortable subject today here on the radio, Pastor?
Well, I think we need to talk about it, and I think that there's not as much a political push for euthanasia as there was for abortion, because abortion is really, those that are pro-abortion are mostly out of the feminist camp, and feminism has been a rising political movement. It really took off in the 1970s, and that's why it was successful in obtaining its demands. There's not that same type of political movement with the interests of those type of parties of a specific group. This issue of euthanasia is something that potentially can affect any family with elderly members that don't die suddenly. And I remember in my last congregation in Oak Park, Illinois, we had a couple of members that died suddenly. You know, they keeled over in their kitchen, and that was it. And it was most of my congregation were elderly people. And I often heard them saying at the luncheon after the funeral, they said, "Boy, I wish I could go like that." So everybody knows that, I mean, anybody that's an adult knows that you will die at some time. And it may be quick, or maybe it may take a long time. It may be with no pain, it may be with a whole lot of pain. You have no way of knowing what this will be. But it's not like, I really don't think that there is a whole political group that's meeting together and writing journals and to get rid of Granny.
Well, I agree with you. However, okay. However, there is an emerging group, particularly with the passage of national health care, there is an emerging group that not necessarily so much pro or con euthanasia, but is very adamant about saving money and fighting against the deficit. The article says here, as President Obama said, most of the uncontrolled growth in federal spending and the deficit comes from Medicare. Nothing else comes close. Almost a third of the money spent by Medicare, about $66.8 billion a year, goes to chronically ill patients in the last 2 years of life. So, if we have a budget problem, a deficit problem, $14 trillion and counting right now, Pastor, and the time comes where we have to cut some things, these people are lining up to cut this medical funding to elderly people. And these people are beginning to make the argument that the way you cut that funding is to let these people die, or maybe even facilitate those deaths. So it won't be a pro-euthanasia argument. It'll be a pro-budget deficit argument.
Well, the again, it's like the really costly thing is heroic measures. You know, like a transplant, there's an enormous cost in there. If you go through that, even just, let's say, if you have bypass surgery, excuse me, that is a type of transplant, and you look at the bill, you're going to be ready to hit the floor right then. You know, because you have got medical coverage, you're only going to get a little bit of that that you're going to pay for yourself. Well, bypass is a heroic measure. A lot of people get it. That's why men are living into their 90s now, I think, bypasses and stents and all these other things. So if the government decides it's not paying for that, or that it's not going to kick in extra money, then everybody will be on their own. And if you can't afford it, then you'll just pass away. That is not euthanasia. Again, that goes. It's a political decision of how we're using the money that's in the economy or for the general welfare. So you really can't say that there's an ethical decision there. And even if it comes to care for people in, let's say, nursing homes or assisted living, there, if it was too much for the government to help out of, what is it, Medicare, Medicaid, for nursing care, these older people could go back to living with their children or with somebody, and they could be hydrated and nourished, and that would not be killing. So in other words, if you totally ran out of money for the government to pay for all these things, there still would be no excuse for saying, oh, we have to put these people out of their misery, quote. So that there are other ways of dealing with it. Now, everybody's unhappy when there's cutbacks and more of the financial burden falls on the individuals or families, but then they'll just have to make do. It doesn't necessarily mean that we end up in a system where older people are put to death.
Well, forgive me, Pastor. Pronounce absolution on me, if you would be so kind, for being so cynical and pessimistic here. But I wonder, I fear that 10, 15 years down the road, we may evolve as a society to the point where, yes, we are now comfortable with withholding heroic measures, okay, and now we are comfortable with facilitating death, and then we're comfortable with euthanizing people, and we arrive at a place where when the Gabrielle Giffords shooting happened in Arizona and she was shot in the brain, instead of reacting as we have with heroic measures to care for her and do everything within our power to try to return her to as close to a normal life as she had, somebody somewhere, some bureaucrat somewhere will say, look, she took a bullet to the brain. I don't care what you do. She's not going to be the same. She's not going to be able to fully recover. And spending millions and millions of dollars in care for somebody like this doesn't make budgetary sense. And so while we couldn't possibly imagine turning our backs on her today, maybe in 15 years we will. What do you think?
Well, the interesting thing about the these go in opposite directions. In the abortion issue, the real legal argumentation that justified abortion was that each person, each individual under the Constitution and our founding documents, each person has the right to determine their own morality. It's what theologians call an existentialist theology or morality. And so what the abortion business was established upon is that each woman has a right to determine what's going to happen to her body based upon her own values and own morality. And the prohibition of her obtaining an abortion, see, nobody is forced to get an abortion. People are permitted to get an abortion.
Well, at least not in this country.
Right. In our country, right. That's what I'm saying. And so the concern the Christians have had is that we were prohibiting, or I'd say all religious views, were prohibiting abortion because we saw it as a breaking of the Fifth Commandment. And the constitutional argument was on the basis that religious values cannot be forced upon individuals because each individual has to determine their own morality. Now, I don't think that reasoning was correct, but that's how it was argued. Now, if we go to the point of euthanasia, what you are saying is that the individual or his or her agents, which would be usually his family or his spouse, who is still capable of making decisions for them, then the government's going to override that. Well, that would completely go against the other direction. In other words, abortion was saying every person makes their own decisions about beginning and end of life. And then you're saying that we'll end up in a position where the government makes a decision about end of life. Well, if they did that, that goes contrary to the complete legal basis of what abortion was all about. Do you see what I'm trying to say?
I do.
Okay, and that's why...
You're thinking very logically and very clearly here.
Yeah, that's why it's unlikely in our country, as it presently stands, with the highest value that we have is the right of the individual to determine their own life and their own values.
So
it's
we'll
the
take
highest thing.
So we'll take Grandpa into a room at the euthanasia center, the counseling room and will say to him, you know, you really are very old and you really are very sick and it really would cost a lot of money to keep you alive. Don't you think it would make good, logical, and perfect clear sense for you just to say, you know, I've had a good life and I'm done. Take me to the euthanasia room.
Now, it's a possibility that that would end up be. In other words, that the person decides themselves.
That person has a right to privacy. We just need to talk him into it.
Right. The right to privacy, that could be used to argue for that. And, of course, Christians would, again, be against that. So I think
one
that would
hope.
Be a direction that it would work. I mean, I'm not saying that it's right, but within our current culture and our legal understanding, it may go that way.
505-7850-1800-730-2727. I would argue, Pastor, that the right to privacy as articulated legally does not exist in the Constitution, but we found a way to find it in there anyway.
Right.
And
there you go.
If you can do that, then, you know, the sky's the limit. Let's talk with Chet. Hi, Chet. You're on the Bible study. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. First of all, Pastor, the comment you made about the senior members of your congregation, I think you said it was very lucid that reminded me of some of our retired union members. They always keep you up on the political trend because they got plenty of time to investigate. But in regards to the top of your hand, just coincidentally, I just recently watched the HBO movie about Dr. Jack Kevorkian. It's called You Don't Know Jack. And before that, I had the impression that he was just some maniacal guy that had a wrong impression about, you know, what rights, human rights should be, but the way they depicted him in the movie, he was a highly intellectual man, educated physician, and he just had a passion for what he was doing, and it was related to something you said, Pastor, that he felt people had the right to determine their own choice, even in regards to euthanasia. And what I learned from that movie was quite a bit, actually. I recommend it to anyone who hasn't seen it, but he had as many as 138 patients that he euthanized, and many of their family members were supportive of it. Some of the people in his circle were supportive of him. And, you know, it's like what Chuck is saying here. We're headed in that way in society. From what I understand, Dr. Kevorkian, he's out of jail now, and we haven't heard much talk of him. But there are some people who would lean in that direction and support efforts of that sort.
Thanks for the call. Pastor, your thoughts?
Oh, good thinking, Chet. I've not studied Dr. Kevorkian, so I'm taking what you say about him to be true. It's interesting how people's opinions will. Once they think through their own values, on the one side you have what is known as classical Epicureanism, and that is doesn't mean that you like to eat good food. It means that pleasure or the enjoyment of life is the most important thing. And an Epicurean would say they would be in favor of euthanasia because once life gets to be difficult or painful, well, then it should just go because the whole purpose of life is to enjoy life. That would be an Epicurean position. And the Epicurean position is very dominant in the United States, and it has been so in Europe going back to the 19th century, even though we don't realize that's where these ideas are coming from. On the other side, for those that say that the determination of life and when to keep it and you know against issues such as euthanasia and abortion would be the classical Christian understanding, I believe the Islamic people would have a similar view, as would the Jews, and also the Greek and Roman philosophy known as Stoicism. Stoicism says that the what makes you as a person is your willingness to stand up to difficult times. And, you know, so we talk about somebody being stoic. And so a stoic would say, no, you can't euthanize people because this is the most important part of their life, to stand up to suffering and to still be strong in that difficult time. So you see that when the government would look at this and say, well, how are the people going to decide this? Well, the people are all over the place. And so the government can't, as long as we have enshrined the value of privacy, as Chuck just said, the government can't say, oh, you all have to do it this way. And that's why they have this thing called advance directives. so that each person can write down in the standard form that all the hospitals have what they want to be done regarding heroic measures, life support, and stuff like this. And if you're an Epicurean, you're probably going to say, oh, if I start suffering, just get rid of me. Whereas a Christian and Islamic person, a Jew, or a Stoic person would say, I respect the life that God has given to me, and I will stick to that until the body doesn't keep me alive anymore.
Pastor, I don't know if you had a chance to hear our first hour of the Bible study today with Pastor Bill Simmons. We were in the first 8 verses of Romans chapter 3, and I made reference to this article, The Case for Killing Granny, Rethinking End-of-Life Care, in the context of Romans chapter 3, specifically in verse 5. Paul is involved in making an argument here in this chapter, really in the whole book for that matter. But he says in verse 5, "But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? That God is unrighteous to inflict wrath on us?" And then he says, "I speak in a human way." It's the human way that gives birth to conversations like we've been having here today, Pastor Nolan. The case for killing Granny. We can come up with all kinds of reasons for euthanizing elderly people. We can say that it's kind, and we can say that it saves money, and we can say that her quality of life isn't all that good, so we're doing her a big favor. These are all the human way. But I suspect, and this is my question for you, that lurking behind the facade of all those otherwise logical and clear-headed purposes and reasons is a desire to be in a position to do what is reserved to God and God alone, and that's kill other people. Now, that's a kind of a cold and harsh way to put it, but I think it's in play. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a little more practical than that. I think that when a person, let's say, has committed themselves to institutional care, let's say a nursing home, normally, I'm not sure what the current contracts, how they work out, but normally you have to give most of your estate to the nursing home to do that. And the deal is, as long as you're alive, they got to pay for your care. So it works out, sounds like a pretty good deal. Well, if you start monkeying with the system as it presently is and say, well, you can put the person, you know, to sleep, to death, you're killing them. Well, then it's in the financial interest of the nursing home to kill you, because you may have thought you were going to live for 20 years there, and you only live there for 2. Well, boy, did they make out in the deal. That's a very practical matter. The other side of it is that children of the elderly person know that they're in the estate, that is, in the, you know, in the will, and they plan to get a big chunk of the estate. And the longer the granny's in the nursing home, the less of the money out of the state that they will get. So again, there's a very practical reason for wanting him or her to be gone so I can get as much money as possible. So I don't think that it's necessarily an evil demon running around. It's just there's money. And that when you get down to that's what it's all about. And the people that are pushing it, whether they are heirs or institutions, they're trying to get as much as they can out of the piece of the pie.
So what does the Bible have to say about, you know, you and I, we've been just talking about all this, what seems to be an infinite number of complications and possibilities as it pertains to questions like this. Does the Bible have anything to say to this question? Whether it's killing unborn children or killing elderly people?
It just says, do not kill. There is no... It doesn't go into great detail.
But if we just go with do not kill, then the policeman can't shoot, you know, somebody who's trying to commit a crime, and a soldier can't kill the enemy. I mean, it's not quite that simple.
Well, the in the cases of the policeman and the case of war, the killing is used to prevent more killing, so it's a lesser of two evils. So this is how St. Augustine talks about it in some of his works. It's called the just war theory, and we don't need to go into that, but basically by killing a person, you're preventing them from killing a lot of innocent people that have, you know, so that's the way you stop it. It's not that you're actually doing something that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Well, that makes sense, but then that does become the first exception to thou shalt not kill.
Correct. But it's always been there. And that eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and the laws of Moses do have provision for the killing of any number of people for any number of crimes, just murder.
Let me sneak a phone call in here, Pastor, before we run out of time. Harold, you're on the Bible study. Good morning.
Yes, morning, Pastor. Good to hear you again. About abortion, I understand there that some of these abortion clinics they're supposed to be regulated, but they're not regulated. Like this one abortionist who was arrested recently for murder, they found fetuses all over the place there, and it hadn't been regulated. And that's been a question for some time, that they get away with so much in there because the government just don't bother or something. They're not regulated.
Yeah, and I'm not so sure that it's not so much they're not regulated as they're not inspected. There probably are some laws that are not necessarily being enforced. What's your answer, Pastor?
Yeah, I think enforcement is probably, you're correct there, Chuck. It's good to talk to you again, Harold.
Harold's gone.
Yep.
So with about 2 minutes left here, with sort of like, I don't know if you observe a pro-life Sunday at your church or not, Pastor, many people in their churches around the Roe v. Wade anniversary will have a Sanctity of Human Life Sunday. Lutherans for Life, I know they provide materials for those churches that would like to have a Sanctity of Life Sunday. At least annually, we get a chance to ponder on some of these things. Are you generally upbeat, generally pessimistic about pro-life issues in the years ahead?
Well, I'm a historian, so I kind of look at this differently. It's not like I'm looking out into the future and, you know, could go any number of ways. As a historian and watching how societies develop, it's interesting that when societies when they move in a direction that's away from what we call natural law, things really go bad, and not just one or two areas. And either there's economic collapse, or there's social collapse and revolutions. Any number of things can happen. But there's also, because of that, people see this coming, and then they start putting on the brakes. So it's hard to know which way our society is going to go, and that is the American society. But, I mean, it's not like it's hopeless. Because other countries have gone, for example, during the French Revolution, in the later part of that, things really gotten way out of hand. And so then they brought in this guy to set up some order, and his name was Napoleon. And boy, did he straighten them up really quick. It became very conservative French society, and they went out and conquered the rest of Europe. It's just you're kind of unleashing the demons when you play with the basic laws of nature. And so sometimes there's enough common sense in a society that they put on the brakes before it gets too far.
I think you've sounded the alarm, Pastor.
In other cases, they don't. So,
Pastor Martin Nolan, thank you, sir. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for inviting me.
Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana, our guest here on our Bible study program. We are in the Book of Romans in our first hour, and tomorrow Pastor John Lukowski will be here for verses 9 through 20 in Romans chapter 3. I want to remind you that on Thursday of this week, we will be on the road. We'll do a live Bible study from Village Lutheran Church in Ladue. You'll be able to come and enjoy lunch, enjoy the broadcast. Hope to see you then.
Listen to Chuck Rathard and guest pastors Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study Archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.